The passage was narrow, barely wide enough for two grown men to walk shoulder to shoulder, and the floor was clean white sand with chips of bright mica that sparkled and crunched like sugar under his bare feet. The passage twisted like a maimed serpent, and then abruptly debouched into a sweeping valley of lush green, bisected by a tinkling stream that spilled from the rock face near where Butso stood. The valley was a circular basin a mile or so across, completely walled in by the high cliffs. In its centre was a tiny village of thatched huts, but as Tanasi came out of the mouth of the secret passage and stopped beside Butso, both of them looked beyond the village to the opposite wall of the valley. In the base of the cliff, the low, wide opening of a cavern snarled at them like a toothless mouth. Neither of them spoke for many minutes as they stared across at the sacred cave. But the memories came crowding back upon both of them. In that cavern, Tanasi had undergone the frightful indoctrination and initiation which had transformed her into the Amlimo. And on the rocky floor she had suffered the cruel abuse that had stripped her of her powers and made her an ordinary woman once more. Now in that cavern another being presided, in Tanasi's place as spiritual head of the nation, for the powers of the Amlimo never die, but are passed from one initiate to another, as they had been from forgotten times when the ancients had built the great stone ruins of the Zimbabwe.
"Are you ready?" Butso asked at last.
"I am ready, Lord," she replied, and they started down towards the village.
But before they reached it, they were met by a weird procession of creatures, some of them barely recognizable as human, for they crawled on all fours and whined and yapped like animals. There were ancient withered crones with empty dugs flapping against their bellies, pretty little girls with pubescent breast buds and blank unsmiling faces, old men with deformed limbs who dragged themselves in the dust, and slim, mincing youths with well-formed muscular bodies and mad eyes that rolled back into their skulls, all of them decked with the gruesome paraphernalia of the necromancer and wizard. Bladders of lion and crocodile, skin of python and bird, skulls and teeth of ape, of man, and of beast. They ringed Butso and Tanasi, prancing and mewling and leering, until Butso felt his skin itching with the insects of loathing, and he lifted his son high on his shoulder, away from their touching, prying hands. Tanasi was unperturbed, for this fantastic throng had once been her own retinue, and she stood expressionless as one of the horrible witches crawled to her and slobbered and frothed over her bare feet. Dancing and chanting, the guardians of the Amlimo led the two wanderers into the village and then disappeared, slipping away into the thatched huts. However, they were not alone. In the centre of the village stood a setengi, an airy, open-sided hut of white mupani poles, and a roof of neat thatch. In the shade of the setengi there were men waiting. But these were entirely different from the strange throng which had met them at the entrance of the village. Each of these men sat upon a low carved stool. Though some of them were grossly fat and others skinny and stooped, they were all of them surrounded by an almost palpable air of dignity and authority. Though some were white-headed with snowy woolen beards and deeply wrinkled faces, and others were in the prime of their life and powers, they all of them wore upon their heads the simple black headring of gum and clay. Here, assembled in the secret valley of the Amlimo, were what was left of the leaders of the Matabele nation, men who had once stood at the head of the fighting impis as they formed the bull formation of encircling horns and crushing chest. Some of them, the eldest, remembered the exodus from the south, driven by the mounted Boer horsemen. They had fought as young men under the great Mzilikazi himself, and still wore with pride the tassels of honour which he had awarded to them. All of them had sat upon the councils of King Lobengula, son of great Mzilikazi, and had been on the hills of the Ndunas that fateful day when the king had stood before the assembled regiments and had faced eastward, the direction from which the column of wagons and white soldiers was entering Matabele land. They had shouted the royal salute, "Bayeti!" as Lobengula poised his great swollen body on gout-distorted legs,
and then defiantly hurled the toy spear of kingship at the invaders, who were still out of sight beyond the blue horizon. These were the Indunas who had led their fighting men past the king in review, singing his praises and the battle hymns of the regiments, saluting Lobengula for the last time, and then going out to where the Maxim guns waited for them, behind the wagon sides and plaited thornbush walls of the white men's lager. In the midst of this distinguished assembly sat three men, the three surviving sons of Mzilikazi, the noblest and most revered of all the Indunas. Somabula, on the left, was the eldest, victor of 100 fierce battles, the warrior for whom the lovely Somabula forests had been named. On the right was Babian, wise and brave. The honourable scars laced his torso and limbs. However, it was the man in the centre who rose from his ornately carved stool of wild ebony and came out into the sunlight. "Gandang, my father, I see you, and my heart sings," cried Batso. "I see you, my son," said Gandang, his handsome face made almost beautiful by the joy that lit it. And when Batso knelt before him, he touched his head in blessing and then raised him up with his own hand. "Baba," Tanasi clapped her hands respectfully before her face, and when Gandang nodded his acknowledgement, she withdrew quietly to the nearest hut, where she could listen from behind the thin reed wall. It was not for a woman to attend the high councils of the nation. In the time of the kings, a lesser woman would have been speared to death for daring to approach an indaba such as this. Tanasi, however, was the one that had once been the Amlimo, and she was still the mouthpiece of the Chosen One. Besides which, the world was changing. The kings had passed, the old customs were dying with them, and this woman wielded more power than any but the highest of the assembled Indunas. Nevertheless, she made the gesture of retiring to the closed hut so as not to offend the memory of the old ways. Gandang clapped his hands, and the slaves brought a stool and a baked clay beer pot to Batso. Batso refreshed himself with a long draught of the thick, tart, bubbling gruel, and then he greeted his fellow Indunas in strict order of their seniority, beginning with Somabula and going slowly down the ranks. And while he did so, he found himself mourning their pitiful, shrunken numbers. Only 26 of them were left. "Kamuza, my cousin," he looked across at the 26th, and most junior of the Indunas. "My sweetest friend, I see you." Then Batso did something that was without precedent. He came to his feet and looked over their heads and went on with the formal greetings. "I greet you, Manonda the Brave," he cried. "I see you hanging on the branch of the Mkuzi tree, dead by your own hand, choosing death rather than to live as a slave of white men." The assembled Indunas glanced over their own shoulders, following the direction of Batso's gaze with expressions of superstitious awe. "Is that you, Intabeni? In life they called you the Mountain, and like a mountain you fell on the banks of the Shangani. I greet you, brave spirit." The assembled Indunas understood then. Batso was calling the roll of honour, and they took up the greeting in a deep growl. "Sakubuna, Intabeni. I see you, Tambo. The waters of the Bembezi crossing ran red with your blood." "Sakubona, Tambu," growled the Indunas of Kumalo. Batso threw aside his cloak and began to dance. It was a swaying, sensuous dance, and the sweat sprang to gloss his skin, and the gunshot wounds glowed upon his chest like dark jewels. Each time he called the name of one of the missing Indunas, he lifted his right knee until it touched his chest, and then brought his bare foot down with a crash upon the hard earth, and the assembly echoed the hero's name. At last, Batso sank down upon his stool, and the silence was fraught with a kind of warlike ecstasy. Slowly all their heads turned until they were looking at Somabula, the eldest, the most senior. The old Induna rose and faced them, and then, because this was an indaba of the most weighty consequences, he began to recite the history of the Matabele nation. Though they had all heard it 1,000 times since their infancy, the Indunas leaned forward avidly. There was no written word, no archives to store this history. It must be remembered verbatim to be passed on to their children and their children's children. The story began in Zululand, 1,000 miles to the south, with the young warrior Mzilikazi defying the mad tyrant Chaka, and fleeing northwards with his single impi from the Zulu might. It followed his wanderings, his battles with the forces that Chaka sent to pursue him, his victories over the little tribes which stood in Mzilikazi's path. It related how he took the young men of the conquered tribes into his impis and gave the young women as wives to his warriors. It recorded the growth of Mzilikazi from a fugitive and rebel to first a little chieftain, then to a great war chief, and at last to a mighty king. Somabula related faithfully the terrible Mfekane, the destruction of 1 million souls as Mzilikazi laid waste to the land between the Orange River and the Limpopo. Then he went on to tell of the coming of the white men and the new method of waging war. He conjured up the squadrons of sturdy little ponies with bearded men upon their backs, galloping into gunshot range, then wheeling away to reload before the Amadoda could carry the blade to them. He retold how the impis had first met the rolling fortresses, the squares of wagons lashed together with trek chains, the thorn branches woven into the spokes of the wheels and into every gap in the wooden barricade, and how the ranks of Matabili had broken and perished upon those walls of wood and thorn. His voice sank mournfully as he told of the exodus northwards, driven by the grim-bearded men on horseback. He recalled how the weaklings and the infants had died on that tragic trek. And then Samabula's voice rose joyfully as he described the crossing of the Limpopo and the Shashi rivers and the discovery of this beautiful, bountiful land beyond. By then, Somabula's voice was strained and hoarse, and he sank down onto his stool and drank from the beer pot, while Babian, his half-brother, rose to describe the great days, the subjugation of the surrounding tribes, the multiplication of the Matabili cattle herds, until they darkened the sweet golden grasslands, the ascension of Lobangula, the one who drives like the wind, to the kingship, the fierce raids when the impis swept hundreds of miles beyond the borders, bringing home the plunder and the slaves that made the Matabili great. He reminded them how the regiments, plumed and beferred, carrying their great colour-matched war shields, had paraded before the king like the endless flow of the Zambezi River. How the maidens danced at the festival of first fruits, bare-breasted and anointed with shiny red clay, bedecked with wild flowers and beads. He described the secret showing of the treasure, when Lobengula's wives smeared his vast body with thick fat and then stuck the diamonds to it, diamonds stolen by the young bucks from the great pit that the white men had dug far to the south. Listening to the telling of it, the Indunas remembered vividly how the uncut stones had glowed on the king's gross body like a coat of precious mail, or like the armoured scales of some wondrous mythical reptilian monster. In those days, how great had been the king, how unaccountable his herds, how fierce and warlike the young men, and how beautiful the girls. And they nodded and exclaimed in approbation.